Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Shot from 25 yards out. Gemmell's brilliant goal didn't put new heart into Celtic. The old one was good enough to beat anybody. And how their supporters thanked their stars they'd come to Lisbon. But somehow, Inter's defence held firm. Barely 7 minutes from time came the winning goal. Chalmers deflected Murdoch's shot past Sarti. That was how Celtic became the first ever British team to win the European Cup. Billy McNeil and his magnificent men earned the thanks and admiration of their native Glasgow, Scotland, and the whole United Kingdom.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield and tonight we are back for another one of our magazine specials. Hopefully by now you'll be aware on social media that Celtic have been given the These Football Times treatment with regards to its One Club special edition magazines. So tonight we're going to have a little chat about the magazine, we're going to have a little chat about the contents and just generally chat about all things Celtic. Now, my usual compadres for such an occasion won't come as any surprise. So first of all, we'll go with Mr. Stephen Scragg first. How are you, Stephen?
Very well, thanks, Stu. How's it going, Jordan?
Good, although it's only been about, what has it been, about 5 days since we last spoke, and, well, what can I say? What are 5 days for you and your boys?
Yeah, the wheels have wobbled a little bit for the last 5 days, but, you know, this is that little blip in the road, and then it'll all iron out, and they'll just cruise in from this Saturday, basically.
I was wondering if I was technically gifted enough. I would have played back the conversation we had literally about 5 days ago about how you foresaw the blip.
I did foresee the blip. I think any lottery numbers coming through will be greatly received as well. I think, but yeah, you can't keep winning. That's the thing. You know, you just cannot win endlessly. You know, somewhere along the line, you've got to kind of like have this little blip, and all the great teams have done it. And you know, we were saying before, and you know, football, nothing's new in football. It's just everything, all the storylines, all the patterns are recycled, played out in different colours, in different stadiums. And yeah, seeing it many times over. It's not easy when it's your own team. You know, it does take a lot to kind of like quantify that, you know, this is your own team and you don't want them to have that blip. But, you know, it was always going to come at some point. But no, it's one of those. It's just one of those things, and it'll straighten itself out in the coming games.
It is, and like you say, football has a wonderful habit of throwing up stories and patterns. And with that,
yeah, it does.
It's probably quite apt that we move across to Mr. Gary Thacker, who is the supporter of an FA Cup quarter finalist in the shape of Chelsea. Gary, you must feel pretty good about yourself right now.
Well, I thought we could have beaten by 6 or 7. I just echo what Steve says. You know, a great result for us, and you know, I think on the day we deserve to win. But you know, Liverpool are going to walk the league quite comfortably, and no team goes it was like unbeaten forever. They got to lose again sometime, and I think we just caught them at the right time. But you know, I was delighted. I thought we played particularly well, and you know, neither club had the first team out, and but you know, I'll take it. Win over the team, 20 points clear at the top of the league. I'll take that any day of the week.
So obviously, guys, we're here. We'll introduce our special guest and our. Well, we'll say Celtic specialist, but I feel that might put him under a little bit of pressure. But we'll introduce the guests in a minute. But obviously, the Celtic magazine, Gary, you know, you've contributed an article to it, right?
I have indeed, yes. One of the, he's certainly one of the greatest Celtic players of all time and vastly underrated and probably one of the most... deserved to be recognised as one of Europe's greatest players of all time. And I've been delighted to talk about him. It's somebody I remember playing in the 1967 European Cup final when Celtic won the trophy. Jimmy Johnston, Jinky to all Celtic fans. So I'd be delighted to talk about Jinky. And I wrote a piece about him in the magazine, which was an absolute joy to write because I remember the magic of the guy with the ball at his feet, the mad little hunch style. He went round players time and time again.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Stephen, no surprise as to your article subject?
No, sense of déjà vu, maybe. But,
that's all right.
I've taken Dalglish, but it is just primarily is Celtic things and you know the rough and smooth of it because they were massively devastated when they lost him, but what they had with him was the formative Dalglish and, you know, the Dalglish that became a world-class player. So, you know, they got to see a different side of Dalglish than we did at Liverpool.
Okay. Obviously, I don't like talking about myself on it. The best bit about the job that I have is that I don't actually talk about myself at all. I just throw out questions. My article is on the striking gifts of the 1980s. So I've looked at the champagne and chocolates of Charlie Nicholas, Frank McAvenny, and Brian McClair. So that's where I've gone with my article. But more importantly, I suppose we should probably introduce tonight's guest, which I'm always delighted to have him on, always... I think pathos is the right word. Always some subtle, dark humour involved. and it's one of these Football Times senior writers. Great guy, great to listen to and great to talk to. And that's Mr. Chris Weir. Chris, how are you?
I'm all the better, Stu, because not only for that fabulous introduction, but also we've talked about the great Liverpool team. They just couldn't... hurdle that last obstacle of going an unbeaten season, a feat only reserved for the finest of squads. 2004 comes to mind. I can't remember which team it was, but I know they were very good to watch. But yes, this season might be pretty deplorable from an Arsenal fan's point of view, but I mean that defeat to Watford at the weekend was probably the most enjoyable game of the season. It was very, very sweet.
I must admit, when this was all put together, I didn't envisage that you would be the happiest guest on tonight's show, but turns out you actually
really
are. Yeah, I like it. I like this new side to you, Chris. I've got a lot of time for it. So, obviously, as well, Chris, for you, you know, you've written for the magazine as well. What's your article topic?
My article is on the Martin O'Neill years. O'Neill obviously came from Leicester at a very crucial time in Celtic's history. And I'm sure we'll get into it in more detail, but he was the man of the moment. He came at a time when Celtic's short and medium-term future was less than clear. The club were under new management, O'Neill at the time. The move to Celtic was seen as something of a bit of a surprise because it's scary. Believable now, but back then he was being linked very strongly with the United job. I think recent history has cast O'Neill's legacy in general in quite an unfavourable light. Suggestions that the game has moved on, that he can't manage modern footballers. But if you ask any of the players who he managed, who played for him, both at Leicester and Celtic, and probably latterly Aston Villa, you get a unified message. You get a leader of men who really got the grips with the task at hand, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but at Celtic he faced the largest task probably of his career and faced it down tremendously. A man who perhaps doesn't get the credit in the modern game as much as he should. So the article was really about trying to reclaim some of that legacy. I mean, in the eyes of Celtic fans, his legacy is probably untouchable. They know what he did. But in the wider game, I think there'll be a few non-Celtic fans who read it, or even casual fans or more recent fans who don't appreciate the scale of the task that Neil had and the scale of the success he brought. So I'm hoping to try and shift the narrative a bit on that with my piece.
Excellent. It's good. Actually, I'm quite listening to you speak there. I'm quite interested as well, because we'll talk in a lot more detail, but I'm quite interested as you were talking then, and the sort of first thing that sprung to mind as you were talking, really, I suppose, is that Martin O'Neill, you know, could essentially be described as a disciple of Brian Clough, and that's probably something that I will be interested in asking. So hopefully the people who are listening are interested, because that is what I'm going to ask you. But it just sort of struck me then as you were talking about the challenges that he faced and how he did it, that obviously he came from played under a manager who was very, very good at dealing with those sorts of problems, Leeds United aside. But we will get into that. So the magazine obviously is out, you know, it's out on social media in terms of awareness of it. It's available to order. It's the same price as it always has been. It's £10. The articles, again, have been written by some of the very best writers that we have at These Football Times. They cover a whole, multitude of subjects, the foundations of Celtic. We talk about Jock Steen, Jimmy Johnson, as Gary's mentioned, Billy McNeil. We have an article on the Battle of Montevideo. We have Dalgleish. We have Meyer, the strikers of the 1980s, the centenary year. Obviously, a little bit about the Old Firm, the ground that they play at, Wim Jansen in that 97-98 season. We look at Henrik Larsson, obviously yours as well, Chris, and Martin O'Neill. We look at Nakamura, there's an interview with Lubomir Avcic, and then obviously the Brendan Rodgers Modern Revolution. So, the magazine goes right through the history of Celtic Football Club. And, I think anybody who is either a fan of Celtic as a club, or again, is just a fan of football and has a particular interest in a club or wants to learn a bit more about a club, certainly the article lineups in this magazine spans a great club with a great tradition and great history, but it seems to me to have captured the important stories. And obviously tonight, we're not going to go through every article and discuss them and sort of spoil the surprise for people who are hopefully going to buy it. But I think we will pick out a few bits and just talk in general about Celtic Football Club. And I think probably the best place to start, I suppose, are the Lisbon Lions, Jock Steen, and that that very first European Cup final victory against Inter Milan. Gary, I know you have an interest in that Inter Milan side that Celtic overcame in 67, but I suppose starting with you and really the importance of that British side, that first British side to win a European Cup.
As you mentioned, Celtic were the first British side to win the tournament, and the team that were playing against the Internazionale of Helenio Herrera. This is the grand Inter who had won successive European Cups earlier in the decade and were many people's favourites to win the tournament again. Outstanding side that they had. And Celtic had come through the competition, I won't say easily, but fairly comfortably. And one of the star attractions, he says, blending nicely into his own article,
excellent.
Was the little guy on the right flank with the number 7 on his back. Was Jimmy? I don't think he had number 7 on his back. They wore numbers on the back of the shirt in those days. It was Jimmy Johnston, and they played Nantes in one of the earlier rounds. And the French press went absolutely overboard about this play of Johnston, because obviously he was a sort of revelation to some continental sides. Because British football, this was obviously before wall-to-wall coverage of TV of all the leagues across the continent. And as Celtic progressed, his fame sort of spread. And when they got to the final, he was clearly the man that would have the most influence for Celtic over the tournament. And Herrera had decided to deploy their, more robust sort of defender against him. And Bergnich and Jockstein, who wasn't averse to seeing these sort of things happen, had decided that he would put the ploy to the sword a little bit by allowing Johnston to roam around. And he took Bergnich all over the pitch, uphill, down Dale, and still managed to find the gaps to prompt and prod forward for his forwards. The game itself, Celtic fell behind relatively early. Matsola scored from a penalty spot for a fairly, less than totally clear penalty, shall we say. And for a long time, despite Celtic having a lot of the pressure and lots of long-range shots, Inter held out. And it was Tommy Gemmell, the fullback, actually, who cracked a ridiculously well-struck shot past Giuliano Sarti, the Irish goalkeeper who was in goal for Inter, to get the equaliser. And then Steve Chalmers deflected a cross past him again for the winner. And it was the crowning glory of Jockstein for Celtic. They went on to succeed in other things as well after that. But to be the manager of the first British club to take the European Cup, the prime competition in European football for clubs, was an outstanding achievement. And as I say, Jimmy Johnston was a wonderful, talented player, and he was a star of that team. And he was actually voted by the Celtic fans as the all-time greatest player, if I remember me right. But strange enough, his career in Celtic didn't start that well. First game he played was in March 63. Celtic played Kilmarnock away. And he was just an 18-year-old kid playing up on the wing for his first time. And he was slight when he was older, so you can imagine what he looked like as a teenager. And Celtic got thumped 6-0. Now, anybody watching that game that day would have been, I think, not absolutely convinced that they were watching a player who would eventually be voted by the Celtic fans as the best player of all time in the Celtic shirt. Johnston had this ability to beat a player. Now, it sounds a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? A little bit farcical, but not many players can do that. But this guy could do it so many times, and he used to explain why he did the things that he did by little quotes. He said that. Because he came from a very poor area of Glasgow, as a lot of the players did in that team. Football was the greatest part of our lives, he said. And just like the boys from Brazil and Spain, they lived in poverty like us. And that's where all the great players came from. They came from the street. And I was always the entertainer. The pitch was my stage. The whistle meant it was showtime. I'll say, in 2002, Celtic voted Jinky as the club's greatest ever player. One of the things that drove Johnston on, his brother, who was also a very talented player, suffered a cartilage injury while he was playing for a Boys' Guild team. He was also on Celtic's radar, but the injury finished his nascent career. And Johnston always remarked that he remembers the effect it had on his father when his brother had to stop playing. And that's one of the things he said that drove him on. But I think it's important to remember that in a player like Jimmy Johnston was in almost the worst situation he could possibly be. He was a guy who was going to beat players and make them look stupid. And he would get kicked an awful lot of times. And I think we're going to touch on perhaps later the Intercontinental match against when they play the champions of South America. And Billy McNeil once said about Johnston in that game, because he got kicked from pillar to post, and he said, what a heart Johnston had. He would just get kicked up and down. He said, just get up again and run straight back at him. Because that was Jimmy Johnston. That's what he did. The ball is free to go around the player. A wonderfully entertaining player. And who never really, as I say, got the acclaim that his talent deserved.
It's I suppose it's quite a big opening there, Gary, that we've made him the greatest ever player in the first 10 minutes. There's only really one week to go now. But it's a great opening. And like we say, you know, the reason why we've picked Celtic for the magazine, you know, it's always a joint decision by the guys at These Football Times. You know, we look for clubs who have stories about players, stories within the club, stories within the history, stories from the pitch. You know, and that's just one article that you mentioned there, Gary, about one player. And, you know, and this just sort of backs up really why we chose Celtic for this magazine. But obviously coming to you, Stephen, you know, we talk a lot about a whole load of stuff, as I seem to say every episode. But, you know, we talk a lot about the great Liverpool managers, you know, Shankly, Paisley, Dalglish, Fagan, and that run through the boot room. And I suppose, you know, to me, Jock Steen, you know, there's that likeness there with some of those Liverpool managers, you know, in terms of their beliefs in the game, that their ability to build teams, their ability to win football matches, I suppose, and win trophies.
Yeah, it's that driven aspect. You know, there's a Scottish trinity, isn't there? There's Shankly, there's Steen, and there's Matt Busby, and the three of them, you know, just built this footballing ethos that, you know, was just incredible, really. You know, the success that the three of them had, and the, you know, the empires that they built, and that's what it was. It was empire building stuff, and Jock Steen, you know, is up there with them, you know, if not eclipsing them. You know, on the back of the 1967 European Cup final, when Shankly, you know, walked into the dressing room and proclaimed to Steen that he was immortal now. And that was Shankly's take on it. You know, it was the greatest achievement ever. You know, certainly up to that point, if not beyond. You know, and winning in 67 was just absolutely massive. You know, to beat the English teams, to be able to say the first British team to be champions of Europe. You know, true champions of Europe. You know, and to put such a team together that were drawn to from such a small area. You know, a circumference of about 30 miles, I think it is, of Parkhead. And, you know, and Steen put this incredible side together. And it was no fluke either. You know, he'd been a player for Celtic himself. You know, he'd been kind of passed over for the job. He went elsewhere. He built a really good side at Dunfermline. Dunfermline's probably the finest ever side. You know, won the Scottish Cup and built this fantastic side, but was tempted back to Celtic, and then did what he did. You know, not just to win that European Cup, but to take them back to another final 3 years later to win those 9 successive titles, and have this massive omnipresent success during an era where it wasn't just a cartel between Celtic and Rangers as well. We're talking kind of like, you know, a fine power base in Edinburgh, you know, and Dundee as well. You know, these were, you know, fine sides. So not just Rangers. You know, these were, you know, great sides that Celtic had to compete with on home soil before going away to conquer Europe.
I mean, you know, exactly what you're saying there, Stephen. You know, this dynasty that was built. And I suppose, Chris, you know, what I'm interested in, certainly, you know, so, you know, you've written about some of the more contemporary issues at Celtic, and I just wonder, you know, in your opinion, whether the legacy or the shadow that potentially hangs over from Jock Steen's era, from being European Championships, and whether Celtic of a more modern era suffers under that weight of what was achieved in 67, or whether it is actually just an accepted proud heritage, if you like, that they just absorb and are very realistic about the prospect of it happening again.
Yeah, I think it's the latter, because you have to appreciate that they're two totally different contexts. We've spoken already about the fact that, with the exception of one player, all of the squad was born within a 30-mile radius of Glasgow city centre. You know, in the modern-day game, the half of that team would have been away before they were 12. So it would have been to Barcelona or Real Madrid, the summer clubs in England. It's a very local story that was possible only within that context. And it's that history isn't a noose. It's actually the thing that really established Celtic's heritage in a way, because There's something very romantic about the fact that, yes, all the players were local, but it's in many ways a funny story as well, because one of the things that, in the course of research for this, that I came across was the fact that at the time, several of the Celtic players had false teeth, and those false teeth were kept in the goalkeeper's cap in the nets. And, of course, the players were too busy celebrating the famous victory over Inter that they left their false teeth on the pitch, whilst thousands of celebrating fans ran on. Now, none of the fans who ran onto the pitch realised that the teeth were in the hat. So it's just a shame that no one realised they could have had one of the Lisbon Lions' famous teeth. But, like I said, it's a story that couldn't happen in the modern game. And I think that only adds to the romanticism of it. But in terms of the historical aspect, I think it became more of a weight, especially as Rangers pulled away in the modern sense. Now, as we know, a lot of that success was built on foundations of sand. But at the time, whenever Rangers were putting ahead as the premier modern force, and Celtic had this massive looming history, and a team of legends who were just far and away better, legends in the side's history, it became something of a burden to the Celtic players. But with the arrival of Wim Jansen, who really arrived at the perfect time. I'm sure we'll talk about him a bit more in detail later on. But before he arrived, Rangers were obviously 9 titles in a row. They had really established players like Jörg Alberts. Whenever I was growing up, he was in his prime, and I just felt like every time he got the ball from 20 to 25 yards out, there would be a left foot hammer straight into the net, and he always seemed to score against Celtic. So that Rangers side in the early 90s was absolutely fearsome, and Celtic were very much the junior partner in the Old Firm. So it was very intimidating, and it's clear that Celtic had an inferiority complex that was born not just from Rangers' supremacy, but the fact that they had fallen so far away from their own glorious history, I think.
It's a great, there are great points, Chris, and I think you're right. I think, when we look at Celtic and where they stand in British football, if you like, in European football, and that heritage, certainly that Steve has mentioned as well about being that first British European Cup winning side, it is something to be embraced, and they are things that can't be compared, if you like. They're, they are literally generations apart. But it's we will bring it up to a more contemporary date. But I suppose before we start to go through the years, if you like, with Celtic, and you're right, it's not always been periods of success. Anybody who sort of has recently followed football and look at Celtic's success and dominance at the moment, that certainly hasn't always been the case. But a player that you touched on, Gary, who, to me seems to span, I suppose, almost from where we've started chatting about with regards to that European Cup victory almost to present day, and obviously, sadly losing him just recently, and that's Billy McNeil.
Yeah, well, Billy McNeil was the captain of the team that won the title, the European Cup in '67. He played over 800 games for the club. It was, almost the epitome of a one-club man. 18 seasons with the club. It won 9 successive league championships. It also actually went back and managed the club in 2 periods, between 78 and 93 and between 87 and 91, and won 4 league championships with as a manager there. So this is a true legend of the club. And any football fan has got a player who they think is the sort of the heart of their team, and very few players, let alone fans, would argue that Celtic's heart, beating heart, was Billy McNeil. And he scored so many important goals as well. I've touched on the Intercontinental game that followed their success in the European Cup final, and it was Billy McNeil who scored the goal on the home leg of that, and he used to pop up with so many goals as well. A truly outstanding defender, and as you mentioned, sadly lost quite recently, and there's a statue outside of the Celtic ground there with Billy McNeil holding the European Cup, and I'm sure it's something that most Celtic fans have a misty eye at when they walk past it.
I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of players that have been written about, you know, throughout the magazine. And obviously, you know, Gary, you've mentioned one that you've written about, Jimmy Johnson. We've just talked about Billy McNeil there. And I suppose, you know, like we said, Stephen, at the beginning, it's no surprise where... And that's not meant in any way. I mean, you know, you always get the best people to write about certain subjects who know the subject, you know, better than anyone else. And obviously... You know, you've chosen Dalgleish, and I think it's certainly interesting. I'm looking forward to reading it, but obviously you're not going to tell me a little bit about it, which is great. But you know, your take on Dalgleish as a player in at Celtic, but perhaps not so much more importantly, but obviously that transition to your club, to Liverpool, then obviously the impact he had there, which, you know, isn't so much what we're going to talk about now, but it is that movement, that tradition of movement of Scottish players that goes right back to the sort of the early 1900s, that tradition of the best Scottish players coming down that West Coast to Liverpool, Manchester. You know, and this was just another case, if you like, of that happening.
Yeah, it was what's fascinating as part of that is Celtic and Steen's stubbornness in keeping hold of him for as long as they did. I think he was just short of 26, 27 when he went to Liverpool. And traditionally, a lot of the best Scottish players would move on at around about 23. And there was this, you know, struggle to allow him to leave. And Dalgleish had wanted to leave from around about 75. You know, he put in a transfer request 2 years before he left. And Jock Steen was involved in a near-fatal car accident in the summer of 1975. And Dalgleish as part of that, because Steen was missing for a year, 1975-76, and Sean Fallon, his assistant, led Celtic, and Dalgleish kind of thought, well, I can't leave now, I've got to stay. And he was given the captaincy and Celtic, you know, for Celtic, he was one of the guiding lights to try and get through this difficult period. And then when Steen returned, you know, again, he stayed for one last season. And what a season it was, because, you know, he brought all of this success in 76, 77. But Dalgleish kind of exhausted himself at Celtic. You know, there's this amazing domestic success and domination, yet that... tantalisingly, the European Cup, you know, European success was just out of reach, you know, and they came close with Celtic. You know, 72, they reached another European Cup semi-final that they lost on penalties to Inter Milan. And then there was an absolutely brutal set of games in 74 against Atletico Madrid in the semi-finals. So, you know, he just came short, and Dalgleish's, you know, own ambition kind of took him away from Celtic in the end. But for Celtic, and then this is what I touch on the article, is that difficulty in letting go, you know, because Liverpool had actually, when Liverpool took him, they'd felt the same sense of loss when Keegan had left. And I draw a little bit of a parallel between the two, is that Keegan's Eye of the Storm, when he was a Liverpool player between 71 and 77, Dalgleish's Eye of the Storm was exactly the same as Keegan's was for Liverpool. You know, he was signed by Celtic in the summer of 67, just as the European champions. He spends a year at Cumbernauld United, scores goals for fun, wins his respective honours with them. But, you know, Steen wanted him to stay another year there, but Dalgleish was eager to kind of like succeed and to get into the Celtic side, so he insisted on staying. But essentially, for the next three seasons, Dalgleish is very much on the periphery, and other players come through ahead of him, including kind of Lou Macari. But Dalgleish had always been ahead of the arc. He'd always been kind of like punching 2 years above his weight. You know, in the summer of 66, you know, he went to Liverpool on trial. You know, trial week at Liverpool, trial week at West Ham. But in the end, kind of like his pull to be back in Glasgow and to try and impress at Rangers was the thing. You know, as a Rangers fan, and that's the other fascination in it, is that Dalgleish had grown up a Rangers supporter, his dad a staunch Rangers fan, but it was Celtic that came knocking. So you also have that side of the story, is that You know, Celtic was never a reluctant Celtic player. He fully embraced Celtic, and you only have to look at the goals that he scored against Rangers and the successes he had in a Celtic shirt against Rangers, that it was never a case of divided loyalties. Once he was a Celtic player, he was a Celtic player. But there is this multifaceted fascination in Dalglish's time at Celtic. Yes, you know, he wanted to pull away and he was denied that, or he was delayed that. But it wasn't for a lack of love for Celtic by any means. You know, he'd won everything he could win with them domestically, but he wanted to test himself in the English First Division particularly, and that he wanted those European glories. And, you know, he left Celtic with the idea that if it didn't work out, he could go back to Scotland and take up where he left off. But, you know, to do what he did, In a Celtic shirt, you know, it's one of these things that, unless you're a Celtic supporter, I think it falls under the radar. Yes, Dalglish was a Celtic player, but it tends to go unexplored. It doesn't, you know, people don't tend to go into it in such detail.
You're absolutely right. That whole, you know, a lot of, you know, Dalglish's legacy is so bound up at Anfield and tied up in Liverpool, and rightly so.
Yeah, there tends to be this kind of like, well, yes, Dalglish played for Liverpool, but in 1977 he left. You know, he played for Celtic, but he left for Liverpool in 1977, and this is where the story begins. But there's such a massive story, you know, over his time at Celtic and being part of what was called the Quality Street Gang, which was this absolutely outstanding Celtic reserve side of the era that won all of the demographic, you know, trophies, and they were kind of like some of them came through and they were the successors to the Lisbon Lions, basically. You know, Dalglish eventually made the serious breakthrough in 71-72, and he never looked back. But, you know, he was part of a, you know, a wonderful youth side that was cultivated with an eye on the future, and that was Steen's genius. And there's not many managers that have managed to be able to do it, is to look at a team that they've currently got and being so successful, but not to be tempted to hold on to it for too long, to be able to regenerate that side and for it to evolve into something different. And that's what Steen did with his transition from the Lisbon Lions side to this flood of talent that came through from the Quality Street Gang.
I mean, obviously, you know, Chris, I apologize, no one can help when they're born, and obviously Gary, myself and Stephen are quite a bit older. And obviously, you know, within the magazine, you know, we have articles, you know, Jimmy Johnson, Dalglish, Larson, Nakamura, but I suppose I'm interested in terms of contemporary, and by contemporary I mean 2000 onwards. You know, who do you see as this, you know, modern era, the most iconic Celtic player of the modern era? You know, maybe a player who's going to be looked back like Johnson or McNeil or Dalglish.
I think no one's going to be shocked when I say that a certain Swedish striker has to be the player. I mean, there's just no one else. But when Henrik Larsson arrived, you know, he was a quality player. He had already had in 1994 a really successful World Cup with Sweden. But by then, by 1996, 97, he'd done well to Feyenoord. But the fact that he arrived at Celtic, courtesy of Finn Jansen, it wasn't heralded as a massive coup at the time. And even as Larsson was introduced to the Scottish League and continued scoring goals by the hatful, it was very slow to get the recognition that his talent deserved. And one of my favourite things growing up would be to make fun of my brother, because he was a massive Celtic fan. And I always used to tell him, hey, Larsson's good in the Scottish League, but he couldn't score goals in the Premiership. And, you know, it was just, and it used to rise Celtic fans up, because they could see every week how good this guy was. And when you look at him physically, not the tallest, not the strongest, I rarely do you find a player as intelligent and as ruthless when it came to finishing. A player who could work with John Hartson, who could work with Chris Sutton, who could work with Ljubomir Moravcik. He never had a player that he couldn't form a successful partnership with. And that speaks to his, ultimately, his football intelligence, but also his adaptability. He was a guy who, let's remember, faced one of the most horrific leg breaks that any player has had to endure. I remember, I think it was against Lyon maybe in the UEFA Cup or Champions League when it happened. And I remember the bone poking out of the sock at the time. And he came back, and I think it was the season after that when he might have scored 53 goals in a single campaign. So not only one of the most intelligent player probably in the modern Celtic era, but one of the most resilient. And as well as that, one of the most loyal, because whilst I might have been and other people might have been slow to appreciate his talent, bigger clubs in the modern sense in terms of financial firepower were in for Henrik Larsson, and he largely turned them down. Basically, similar to the Kenny Dalglish phenomenon, you know, Larsson left Parkhead relatively late in his career to join Barcelona. He gave his best years to the club, and it was he, along with the likes of the management of Wim Jansen and Martin O'Neill and a supporting cast, but it was that really made Celtic the modern force that they are. So I think if you're going to narrow it down to one player, it has to be Henrik Larsson, and no one else really comes close.
I'm not trying to be glib or condescending, but I just want to go back, to touch back on that point. And you know, you're right. You know, a wonderful, wonderful footballer, incredibly intelligent. Do you? And this is not meant to be disrespectful in any way, but do you think there will always be some sort of? I suppose. You know, it was only Scottish football, and that's in no way intended to be disrespectful, but it's. You know, it's you can only play. You know, you perform in the league that you're playing in. But do you think he was good enough that legacy will transcend whatever league it was in? So of that era, he was just that good.
Yeah, I think you're right to point that out. At the time, there was very much an element of he's very good for the Scottish league. But I think that whenever he moved to Barcelona and had that short spell at Man United, I think if you ask the fans of both those clubs, they realised just how talented a player he was, especially at Barcelona. He wasn't an automatic starter, but in the likes of the 2006 Champions League final, he came off the bench and made a really crucial intervention to turn the tide in Barcelona's favour. This is a guy who, if you're a real football aficionado, you know that this guy's right up there with the best of them. It was an easy jive to make at the time, but I think people forget just how strong the Scottish League was at that time, and in particular that Celtic squad that he played in. There were a lot of very, very good players playing, especially for Celtic and Rangers at the turn of the millennium there. You had the likes of Tore-André Flo at Rangers. You had Ronald De Boer, Arthur Newman, and Barry Ferguson as well was one of the best young midfielders in Britain. On the Celtic side, you had the likes of Cillian Petrov, Bobo Valde, who at times was just absolutely unplayable, and of course you had Lubomir Mravčić in there as well. So this wasn't a joke league. You know, there's an element of condescension when it comes to Scottish football, but rest assured, Larsson was playing in the competitive league, and I don't care what standard the league is. If you score 53 goals in it, or numbers like that consistently, you're a talent. There's no question.
Excellent. I'm glad you've caught with that answer, because Henrik Larsson is one of my most favourite players, and that's good. I'm pleased that you said it, and it wasn't left to me to say it. I appreciate that. So as we move through now, you know, like I say, I feel quite uncomfortable talking about myself or anything that I've done, but obviously I went down the 1980s, which, as we know, right, is the sweet spot of my love of football. And it was, let's say, it wasn't as quite a successful period. I think throughout the 80s, I think when I was researching the article, I think they won 8 trophies, where they've already won 10 in the last 3.5 seasons. So in terms of the Celtic that we know now, you know, the success wasn't there. And as Steve mentioned earlier, there was Dundee United, there was Aberdeen, there was Rangers, you know, and it seemed that Scottish football was more competitive, should we say. But I looked at the lineage that went through sort of the three strikers, which started with Charlie Nicholas, then progressed to Brian McClair, then progressed to Frank McAvenny. And while Celtic weren't necessarily hitting the success and the domestic success that they have at the moment with regards to trophies, they had this decade, this lineage of strikers who knew where the goal was, played with flair, played with creativity, and gave the fans something to be to be happy to watch, something to see, something to enjoy, even if there wasn't necessarily a lack of silverware, or, you know, silverware did arrive. But I think obviously, you know, I did a lot of research around it, but I have a question. You know, I'll start with you, Gary, first of all, about these three players, just to gain, you know, your guys' perspective as well. So I'm going to come to you, Gary, about Charlie Nicholas. Now, obviously, a great player, wonderful talent, very young when he arrived into the Celtic first team, and then, you know, had massive success at Celtic, great player, scored lots of goals, and then made the trip down to London, and, you know, you have this champagne tag, if you like, or moniker that goes with it as he went to Arsenal. And I suppose what I'm asking you, your perspective, does that tag, that nickname, detract from his ability as a footballer?
I think there's probably two phases to answer that. I think, A, yes, it does, but B, perhaps it shouldn't. Because the press paints so many players with an image that may or may not be relevant to the lifestyle they lead. And, you know, yeah, I'm old enough to remember when Charlie Nicholas came down to London, and there was a sort of similar situation with a guy who, another Scottish guy who came down to Arsenal, Peter Marinello, much earlier. And the same sorts of problems were sort of, stories were told about him. And it's almost the case of, you know, you give a dog a bad name and it's going to stick. And, you know, even to this day, you know, when he does his stints on Soccer Saturday on Sky, you know, they call him Champagne Charlie. And so it's almost become like a badge of honour that he wears now, because that's the image he has and that's the image he carries around with him. But he was still an exceptional footballer, and, you know, you know, Arsenal weren't the kind of club to lay out decent brass for a player who was just going to come down and enjoy the West End and not perform. So, and, you know, his career with Arsenal wasn't as long as perhaps it should have been, but he was still an outstanding talent when he came down from Celtic. And, you know, it's another one of the long line. You know, Dale Gleeson, Stevie was eulogised about earlier, and the other two you mentioned as well, McClare and McAvaney. Also, well, certainly McAvaney had a sort of a checkered press, shall we say, when he was at West Ham. But these guys scored some wonderful goals.
You're right, and that's why, I mean, to be fair, that's why I was, you know, when we were looking at, you know, when Omar was asking for ideas for articles, and I'm always all about the fair players. I don't need substance in my life and in my football. I just need them to show off. That's all I need. So once I've done a little bit about, you know, I looked at Charlie Nicholas and then looked at who replaced him and then looked at who replaced McClare, and there was just this 10 years of goals from sort of three flair players. But and it's McClare that's interesting. I suppose, you know, coming to you, Stephen, McClare goes to Manchester United under Alex Ferguson and seems, out of the three, always seems to be the more steadier, always seems to be the more stable. And I suppose, you know, it's two parts, really. You know, Nicholas was a great success at Celtic. McClare was a great success at Celtic. But McClare under Ferguson seemed to continue, as, you know, as Gary's alluded, maybe Nicholas didn't quite live up to the expectations in London. Had he have gone to, you know, there was rumour that Charlie Nicholas would have gone to Liverpool as well at the time. You know, had he have gone to maybe Liverpool or Manchester United, like McClare did, you know, could it have been a different story?
It could have been. I think he's himself has stated, you know, not a full-on regret, but a partial regret in where he went, when he went. It wasn't that it was Arsenal that was a problem. It was that, you know, London was a problem for him. You know, Arsenal was kind of the right club for him, but it was just in the wrong place geographically. But he was a wonderful player. But yeah, his move to Arsenal was generated by an ideal to be the star of a team. You know, he was attracted to be the star turn of a team. And at Celtic, he was the new Dalglish. He was billed as the new Dalglish. That he was the successor to Dalglish when it came to Scotland. He was being primed as the replacement for Dalglish there. And yes, the links to Liverpool. It was odd. The summer of 83 was that Liverpool were heavily linked with Charlie Nicholas. Neely signed Michael Laudrup and eventually signed Michael Robinson, which was an absolutely intriguing set of of events. But then Robinson was a great player for Liverpool for a year and a half. But yeah, Nicholas was a wonderful player, and he was just part of this metronomic run of strikers that they had. And there were others that worked around them as well, because Nicholas kind of came in. He was Frank McGarvey was another one, because he did sign for Liverpool. You know, he'd started out, I think, at St Mirren. Liverpool signed him, but he never played a first team game for the club. And he actually won Scottish international caps while he was in Liverpool's reserves. And he headed back to Scotland to sign for Celtic on deadline day. So he lasted about 8 months at Liverpool, and then scored goals for fun with Celtic. And then along came Nicholas and everyone else as well. You know, you say McAvenny and McClure, but there was others. I mean, there was Mo Johnson, there was Alan McAnally, you know, and they're all this lineage. And I think there's a mad summer in 1987 where McClure, McAvenny and McAnally and Mo Johnston are all sold. But then McAvenny is brought back to the club as the antidote to this massive loss and this exodus of strikers. And then he was kind of like the genesis of them going out and winning the double in 87-88, the centenary double. And yeah, these strikers just had one success after another, and it was like a relay. There was a passing of the baton between one and the other, to the fact that, you know, when McAvenny came back, and then again he went back to West Ham, but then Charlie Nicholas came back again. So you could probably plot it yourself, but there is this progression of about 15 years worth of outstanding strikers that overlap into this dry period for them in terms of success collectively after the title stop after 88. You know, these strikers become, and then the Mavericks that follow, become kind of like the hope. And that's what happens when a successful team kind of ebbs away as a title winning force, or trophies become more sparse, is that, you know, the striker, the man who's putting the ball in the back of the net, becomes the trophy almost. And, you know, the item that is cherished and celebrated, and they become a hero that carries the club. And Charlie Nicholas bridged both that divide. He was, in his first spell with Celtic, he was, you know, part of a trophy-winning team and a trophy-challenging team, whereas in his second spell, he was this, you know, man who helped carry the club along in a dark period.
It's like you've read my article already. You're absolutely right.
But I am looking forward to.
It is, and you're right. I mean, you know, there is, you know, Mo Johnson's in there and Alan McAnally, and because I can remember reading and thinking, I got it. Although the success wasn't there, it must have been a great time. If you're a fan of football, it must have been a great time to have been at Celtic Park, just like you say, year after year after year. And I suppose, Chris, you know, obviously, you know, Stephen mentioned McAvenny and Charlie Nicholas both go back to Celtic. The second periods there, whereas McClure goes to Manchester United and stays at Manchester United. And I suppose, you know, out of the three of them, you know, which do you think is, you know, probably looked on more favourably with the Celtic fans?
It's a hard one to gauge. I think instinctively, probably McClure is the one that jumps out at me, and he's one that Ferguson himself described as probably his best ever by at United. He had a ratio of 10 goals in 15 games over the course of his 4 years at Celtic. I think he has that element of mystique that maybe Charlie Nicholas has an element of overexposure now with his punditry. McGarvey had his own merits, you know, always be almost alien-headed character, but with an eye for a trick and just fantastic movement. Again, it's a rare feat that you get signed and spotted both by Sir Alex Ferguson at St Mirren and then Bob Paisley at Liverpool. You have to be a special, special talent, and especially to get 25 goals each season on average. But it's rather, I'm going to sit on the fence maybe at this one, but I'll just say something like, it just must have been great to be a Celtic fan in the 80s, because it was just It was just a procession of top quality strikers. Even doing the most cursory research, you see, McGarvey scored 25 goals this season. Then Charlie Nicholas scores 40 goals the next season. And Brian McClure scores 20 goals the next season. It was guaranteed goals. And there were other players on the periphery of that. We've mentioned some of them. But the likes of George McCluskey as well. Didn't score as the same volume as goals, but he's popped up with vital goals as well. For example, his winner in the 1980 Cup final against Rangers was essentially caused a riot that meant the drink was eventually being banned from being taken into the grounds. Probably not the honour you want to have on your CV, but the fact remains that, you know, there was just an absolute embarrassment of riches when it came to Celtic forwards at the time, and it must have been an unbelievable era to sit through.
The amazing part of that is that so many of them overlapped each other. You know, it's like McGarvey played with Nicholas, and then, you know, and it's like the loss of one is supplemented by another, and then, you know, Mo Johnson comes, you know, who is joined by McClure, and then it's like this mad passing of the baton. But within that, the overlap as well, and, you know, the partnerships that blossomed, and then but these partnerships were kind of like short bursts, because one would move along and then someone else would come in, and but still this continuation of vast amounts of goals and continued to be scored.
It was like a relay team of UCM posts. It was just, there was usually in a relay team there's a stronger runner and a weaker one. It's just all top quality forwards. There was never any lag. I think that's the most amazing thing. I think you're absolutely right. It's the overlap. It's one after another. It was an absolute conveyor belt of quality.
You should have seen the YouTube clips I had to get through to write the article. It was an absolute it was an absolute trauma. Just having to watch goal after goal after goal. Obviously, you know, we're already nearly at now, but it's fine. We've got loads of time yet, and I'm sure the Celtic fans are still listening. I imagine Rangers fans have switched off by now, but the Celtic fans will still be listening, so we're all good.
Stuart, I love how you think Rangers fans actually turned this all
around. I'm sure they will. I'm sure they've stuck the first 50 minutes at least. No problem. Yeah. I want to come. In fact, actually, it's quite ironic that, because I want to come to the Old Firm next. Just as maybe they shouldn't have switched off just now. But you know, just coming to the Old Firm, it's not something to spend long on. But I suppose just as an entity, as a game, I'm interested in the three of you. You know, where you see it in the terms of derbies, and I'm talking about, you know, all of world football. You know, sometimes you have the friendly rivalry, you have the fierce rivalry. and I'm just interested in how you see or interpret the old firm derby. You know, I'll start with you, Gary, and where do you see it? Well, so how do you see the Old Firm derby?
I certainly historically wouldn't say it was a friendly derby.
No,
I mean you know you hear about Stevie's area of Liverpool, and everyone fans sitting together in watching the Merseyside derby. That ain't gonna happen in Glasgow, not any time soon anyway. It might be very rare occasions, but not usually. And there's the passion that's engendered by the fans of these two clubs just wouldn't allow that sort of thing. It's one of those rivalries that's almost like a love to hate thing. It's not the same as the Real Madrid Barcelona thing, but there's a famous quotation by I can't remember which former president it was of Real Madrid, but who said something along the lines of, if Barcelona didn't exist, we'd have to invent them, because it was almost a rivalry that defined the club and sort of drove them on. And I think it's a little bit like that to some extent with Celtic. For example, when Rangers had their financial meltdown and sort of disappeared, you'd expect Celtic to sweep the board of trophies over the years when they were sort of adult. It didn't happen. I mean, they won lots of stuff, but they didn't win everything. And it was almost, because they hadn't got to try that hard anymore. That sounds a little bit trite, I know, but I'm sure there's an element of that the rivalry drove Celtic on and drove Rangers on to even greater heights because of the need to beat these other guys.
Stephen, you know, the Merseyside derby. You know, it's something that you're very familiar with, and I suppose in terms of comparisons, you know, it might be easier for you to sort of put that it into context, you know, with regards to the difference between the Old Firm game and the Merseyside derby?
Yeah, I mean, Glasgow's a completely different kettle of fish. The totally different derbies. I mean, you could maybe compare Glasgow to, say, the Rome derby or something similar to that. It's this antipathy between the two clubs that is very, very stark. And, you know, it's a rivalry cast in stone. And other cities have, you know, derbies that, yeah, they're electric. Yes, there's a lot of history there. You know, this Celtic Rangers rivalry has something completely different. It is just a properly hypnotic, and well, you know, it's a almost febrile. You know, maybe not the right word, but it kind of is. There's a sense of lawlessness to it almost, and you know, every rivalry has this propensity and possibility to even Liverpool Everton. There's ugly sides of Liverpool Everton, but you know, Celtic and Rangers is just purely, you know, an almost like an electric hatred.
What a great phrase. As Steve was chatting there, Chris, I've got my question all ready for you, but as he's just finished with that line, I'm not quite sure it's right. But I was going to ask you, Chris, whether it's a healthy rivalry. Is it good for Scottish football? Is it good for Glasgow? Is it good for the two clubs? You know, is it a positive on the whole? Is it a positive rivalry?
It is on the whole, and I think Gary is absolutely right to make the point that it's a symbiotic relationship, and it's a relationship that's really suffered from Rangers' recent troubles. These clubs need each other because they're the only two clubs in Scotland who are of that scale and who have that history, who have the economic and that social power. I probably come from a relatively unique perspective, and not given my own upbringing and where I'm from, just for context, I was born in a working-class Catholic community. Where, you know, you're born and you're a Celtic fan by default. If you like football, it just comes with the territory. Some of my earliest football memories, I know that I'm an Arsenal fan, really, but the Old Firm derbies especially, they were occasions. And I remember going up to Alexa, my granddad's house, because he had BBC Scotland on his, and it used to be all the uncles and the cousins used to get together with their cheap beer from the off lessons and watch it on a Sunday. And the swearing and the smoking and the drinking, and it was just 90 minutes of vitriol, probably is the only way. And you knew that like 90% of the people in the room didn't watch any other Celtic games, didn't know half the players on the pitch, but it didn't matter because it was a them and us scenario. And it was the same on the other side of the so-called divide as well. It was, let's not make any points about it, especially from the Northern Irish perspective. The sectarian element is a massive part of it, and that quote from Stephen about electrocated is right. I would go further and say it's probably something like football's answer to MMA. You watch it knowing that someone's going to get a kick in the head, and there's that a palpable urge of violence, but you just can't turn away. It's constantly on the edge, even in the modern games. When you find out that the Old Firm's happening next Sunday or the traditional New Year's Day game, you get that sort of frisson of nervous excitement that you know things could go bad at any moment, and that's a pattern that's continued right up until the modern history with the likes of Ali McCoist and Neil Lennon's contretemps. You know, it's always bubbling. There's always this implicit suggestion of violence. There's always opprobrium in the stands, and you know, there is that danger that it tipples over into something more sinister. I always remember when Ian Wright went to Celtic, he really felt that atmosphere and didn't enjoy it. And I know when Van Bronckhorst signed for Rangers, he watched the first Old Firm derby in the stands, and he couldn't believe what he was witnessing to that extent. So it's for some players and for some casual observers, that element of hatred is probably too much. But for most of the fans, you know, it's basically the lifeblood of it. It's what gives it its drama, its passion, and the danger of what makes it so exciting.
That's a great answer. And to be fair, it's funny because when I brought this up, and you know, obviously, you know, there's an article in the magazine about it, but it's that looking at it from a player's perspective, and you know, and Scottish players will be well versed in, you know, like you say, in the Old Firm derby. But I suppose you, oh, I certainly, I'm not speaking for you guys, but I, you know, you tend to forget about players who've come from abroad and all of a sudden are thrown into this historical sectarian patch of grass, essentially, with 50, 60,000 fans so close to the pitch, and they then have to perform, you know, like you say, in such an intense atmosphere. You know, they must wonder at times what they've signed up to. As we sort of bring it more up to date, and I suppose I just want to touch on, you know, we mentioned earlier, you know, we've talked about the various periods of domination between Celtic and Rangers as well. And obviously, you know, there is an article on Wim Jansen, that 97-98 season, and that stopping of 10 in a row, Gary. And do you think that maybe sometimes, you know, at the moment, you know, Celtic very much in the ascendancy, and it's all about, you know, you have to wonder whether Rangers are plotting, I suppose the reverse revenge, if you like, as it gets nearer.
Reverse revenge.
Yeah.
That's a good concept.
I was all I could come up with.
just touch on the Wim Jansen thing. I mean, obviously, it was a real strange situation there. He was only there for a single season. Now, I, as a Chelsea fan, there's a sort of link there between Conte, who one season won the title, and then he was, although he survived for the next season, he was always on the way out after that. And crazy, it was less than 48 hours after the league was won, stopping the Rangers' run of getting to 10 titles. He'd left because of an argument with Jock Brown. I mean, you know, this is sort of crazy stuff, but this is what happens in football. But going back to what you were saying about our Rangers play, you bet your bottom dollar they will be, because, you know, as Chris said, you know, this it transcends football. The rivalry between these two clubs transcends football. It's got sectarian overtones, it's got religious overtones, it's got ethnic overtones, and Rangers cannot possibly not be planning, cannot. It's like, that's like a reverse revenge there, mate. It's impossible for Rangers not to be planning to get back on the level par, or you know, even you know, become dethrone Celtic as the prime football force in Scotland, because it's just the nature of the beast. It's impossible for it not to happen.
I mean, you know, coming to you, Stephen, it's, you know, sometimes it's the, not the small victories. I mean, winning a league title is not a small victory, but, you know, Rangers had been so dominant, you know, at that time, and then to just take away at that sort of, you know, on the verge of a 10th title, and to just take it away from them, it's such a sweet feeling, although they've had 9 years of Rangers success, to just stop that 10th, there had to be almost that sweet feeling within it.
Oh yeah, it must be one of the best, I think, for any Celtic fan. I mean, to have lived, you know, such successes as European Cups and reaching another final, and all of their own dominance, their own 9 on a row, and then to see it so close to being usurped. You know, Rangers about to win this 10th successive title, and to outdo what Celtic did, and then there they were to put a stop to it, you know, and it must have been the sweetest of league titles for them.
I mean, obviously Celtic have won a lot of league titles, Chris. Let's be honest about this. There's quite a few to choose from. But in terms of, I suppose, enjoying league success, enjoying anything that is at Rangers' expense, you know, where does that sort of 97-98 title win sit amongst Celtic fans?
It's right up there. I think it's tied with this season and O'Neill's first season. Janssen's success is probably more cathartic and more significant in the sense that it stopped the 10 in a row happening. But Wim Janssen arrived at what could have been a very difficult time for Celtic Football Club. There was disorder in the boardroom. Pierre Van Hooydonk and Ducanio had left the club and something approaching disharmony, you know. It could have been a very difficult campaign. And, you know, if you judge Janssen on first glance, this sort of curly-haired, small, sort of almost perennially baffled-looking Dutchman, you know, you don't look at him and think he's a commander of men, but the way he led that Celtic team, and a team that had his stamp on it, by the way, some of the players he signed, we've already mentioned Larsson, but he was the one that brought Mark Rieber to the club, the talented Danish defender. He was the one that brought Paul Lambert, Champions League winner, to the club. He was the one that used talents like closer to home, like Simon Donnelly and Darren Jackson. And he was arriving from relatively unheralded. I think it was the case that he was in Japan or had recently managed it in Japan. And one quote in the papers at the time said he was only the second worst thing to hit Hiroshima. So it was a guy who faced his fair share of scepticism on his arrival. It could have went pear-shaped. So the way that he triumphed in those circumstances is something that's definitely worthy of admiration.
You mentioned there about Martin O'Neill and, you know, where it ranks in terms of enjoyable league successes. And I suppose, I can't let that opportunity to link go past. And obviously your article is on Martin O'Neill, and you mentioned, right at the very beginning when the Rangers fans were still with us, that you talked about his influence and what he did at Celtic, and the problems he faced and the legacy. And I suppose, I mentioned about being a disciple of Brian Clough, and I suppose I'm just interested in terms of your perception and the angle that your article comes from with regards to O'Neill at Celtic.
It's interesting that we speak about Brian Clough, because Brian Clough always thought that O'Neill was, in his own words, a bit of a smart arse. And that really sums up O'Neill's very peculiarly Irish brand of self-confidence. You know, it's not born of privilege or entitlement, O'Neill's confidence. It's born of devotion and hard work and aptitude. And this is a guy who is of a scholarly bent. A known fan of murder investigations. He's been known to follow famous murder proceedings and had actually begun his legal studies at university in Northern Ireland before ultimately deciding to follow a career in football. So he's a very intelligent man, and I think that gave him a presence that sort of belies this sort of short, bespectacled stature. He was in every sense the leader of men, and it was something that he showcased when he brought Leicester from the second division to the UEFA Cup positions in the late 1990s. And it was his successes at Leicester with a limited side, realistically, that caught the attention of the Celtic board. And it was actually the recommendation of Sir Alex Ferguson through Dermot Desmond that secured him the job. Once they interviewed O'Neill in London for the post, that was it. They didn't need to speak to anyone else. But O'Neill was cognizant of the scale of the challenge at hand. This was a club that, similar to the Janssen, there was, again, a bit of disharmony in the boardroom, maybe a lack of quality in the squad and a lack of organisation and discipline. And if there's one thing O'Neill knows, it's discipline. And it was at that time, John Barnes and Kenny Dalglish had recently departed the club after a really terrible campaign that really dented the club's confidence. It was a very vital period. It needed someone with a strong hand and with the confidence of his convictions. Chris Sutton later on would say that Martin O'Neill never lost an argument in the dressing room, and you can understand it when you see him, when you hear him speak in that views, when you see how he conducted himself. And this is a man of stature. Remember, it's Northern Ireland's first Catholic captain from the national team in the 1980s. That is not something to be sniffed at. You need broad shoulders for that. And he was a vital part of the team that ultimately went to the 1982 World Cup. And at a time when some of his own Nottingham Forest teammates shied away from him because of the context was the IRA campaign of terror in Britain, there were some that felt that O'Neill was maybe a bit too close to that, a bit too sympathetic. But it's an interesting angle, because what comes through in O'Neill is that sort of Irishness. And Celtic is a very Irish club. It has its Irish roots. And it's something that O'Neill was very happy to acknowledge. And it's something that was keenly felt here as well. And I was sort of thinking about this before the podcast, and I don't know whether it's a bit of a tenuous link, but I'll mention it anyway. If you consider the political context here, the Good Friday Agreement was signed 2 years before O'Neill's arrival at the club. Celtic were still very much, I know they had the Janssen triumph, but they were still playing very much second fiddle to Rangers. It might be tenuous, but there was a sense certainly here that the Catholic community maybe was ready for a role model, was ready for a harbinger of success, of modernity, of you know, equal footing that in some arenas that probably hadn't been offered. So O'Neill was a shining example of Irish excellence, if you want to put it that way, at a very Irish club. And I think there's a symbolic part to that. But ultimately, it would have stood for naught had it not been for his sheer competence with the job. And I don't want to ruin the article too much by going into too much details, but if I can just sum up one anecdote. There was just after taking the job, he summoned all the country's top journalists for Celtic to, I think it was the Crutherden Hotel, just outside Glasgow. And he sat all the journalists down, and the first thing he said to them was, "Just to let you all know, I hold grudges." And the people around the table just started laughing, and I each cut them short. He's like, "No, I'm being serious. I hold grudges." O'Neill was a man who was just as firm with the media as he was with his players. But whilst he might have been firm, he was also incredibly loyal. If you committed yourself, if you were devoted, as devoted as he was to the club, then you were under his protection. You were his guy, and it's something that's O'Neill had demonstrated throughout his time at Celtic. Most particularly when, in the case of Neil Lennon, you know, again, had come under some criticism for unjustified criticism for simply playing for Northern Ireland as a Celtic player. O'Neill, during a 2-0 defeat to Rangers at Ibrox, had received tremendous abuse from the home fans. And O'Neill strode onto the pitch, put his arm around Neil Lennon and pumped his fist into the air. Again, it sort of summed up his unwavering dedication to his men. And they were his men, and I think they responded in kind, because what O'Neill did was he treated his players like men who he gave them confidence to carry their tasks. He gave them very clear instructions. He wasn't soft, but did he know how to motivate his players. I mean, if you read up on some of the interviews that his players given, for example, at the 2003 UEFA Cup run, and that the game at Anfield against Liverpool, if you mention both the pre-match and half-time team talks, they just shake their heads and go, "Wow, you know, he had them up to 90 for that game." And it was his motivation, but also that the team he had around him, you know, with the likes of Steve Walford, who was very much hands-on in terms of taking training and being across the details on pitch level, but also John Robertson, who was very much a sounding board. Interestingly, both of them worked for the same insurance company after retirement, Safe and Prosper. And even that fact alone, you think that, you know, can you imagine a modern-day footballer going in to work a real job after retirement? But it was something the players had to do back then. But ever since their shared playing days at Forest, Robertson was something of a sounding board for O'Neill. And he really followed him throughout his career. And O'Neill really suffered when Robertson didn't follow him to the likes of Sunderland. But the three of them together, they were a tight unit. And they really built a strong team. You go through that starting 11. You had Rob Douglas in nets, formidable, solid, not showy, but the job. You had Johan Mjalby, Yusuf Haran, Bobo Baldé, three absolutely insane central defenders. Muscular, strong, real characters, tough man markers, didn't shirk a challenge. Then you had a midfield that, if it didn't have Paul Lambert, it had Neil Lennon, who continues to be underrated in every sense. You had Stylian Petrov, who was a master of movement and late runs into the box. On wings, you had players like Bobby Petta, and Didier Gat, who couldn't cross the ball to save his life, but he could skin four players before he got to the byline to waste a cross. And then on the forward line, you had Larson, you had John Hartson, you had Chris Sutton, and then, of course, you had Libor Miravcic. And I don't think the team that O'Neill built has ever really got the credit it deserves. I mean, in the second season, Celtic breached the 100-point barrier. You know, it's people forget the scale of the success he brought and the transformation of winning the treble in his first season, beating Rangers 6-2 in his first season, you know, being 3-0 up against them in the first 20 minutes. To turn around an ailing institution so quickly and so convincingly and to really maintain that is a feat that doesn't happen often in modern football. And that was why I sort of wanted to write the article, because people, you know, fans now have a very short memory, and they're very quick to forget how tough things were when they're spoiled by success. I'm not saying this about Celtic fans specifically, because I know that they appreciate the scale of O'Neill's successes at the club, but I think generally fans are, you know, you're as good as your last game. There's no appreciation of the work that went in. There's no appreciation of the context that it wasn't all about success. It wasn't all about trophies. There are people who go in when things aren't going right. They get their hands dirty. They do what needs to be done. When people shy away, they don't have the mettle to do it. O'Neill took that job on. He changed that club, and he brought that club back to where it belonged. So I think his tenure at the club, probably one of the greatest managers, if not the greatest, in the club's modern history. So that was what the article was about, just trying to sort of reclaim a bit of that and make people remember just how good he actually was as a manager.
It's great. what a great monologue. I suppose, Gary, I had questions lined up, but Chris was just ticking them off as he went through. Gary, does it, a club like Celtic, you know, a huge, huge club, you know, both domestically and in terms of heritage, tradition, you know, across Europe, are there only certain managers who can ever take jobs like that?
Yeah, so I think, yeah, there are. It's true to say that there are certain managers who can manage clubs like that, but it's identifying them. That's the trick. And for instance, Chris was mentioned earlier about Jensen. Not many clubs would go to San Fries, Hiroshima, if you're a top club, to get your new manager. And yet this was the right guy. So, you know, OK, it's perhaps easier to identify somebody like Martin O'Neill. But to identify, you know, going back in Father Jock Steen was obviously well versed in the history of traditions of Celtic. But yes, it's difficult to find the right manager, knowing where to go for them. Obviously, Brendan just did so well there as well, and he obviously had a good pedigree behind him as well. But yes, you do need to have a certain ability, and you know. Chris just was describing Martin O'Neill's success and how he came about it there. And a lot of what is required are the things that Chris was identifying there. You know, players like to have, it's important that they feel that they have not only the manager's confidence, but also the manager's protection and confidence and belief, you know, affection and love, for want of a description. That's what makes them perform. So, yeah, it is true that you need to have a certain manager, but as I say, the difficulty sometimes is just picking the right guy.
It is. And I suppose, Stephen, it's, you know, Chris made a great point as well about, you know, sometimes people's legacy can be overlooked, you know, not by the Celtic fans, not by the fans who lived it and were there, but sometimes it just takes time, doesn't it, to get a sense of perspective as to what a manager has achieved. And do you think as time progresses, certainly not from Celtic fans, but from people outside of Celtic Football Club looking on at what Martin O'Neill achieved at Celtic, will almost be more admired, more appreciated as time passes?
Oh, I'm sure it will. You know, you're right about that sense of detachment to be able to fully appreciate what a manager or a player did, and I think as time passes, people will realise exactly what O'Neill did at Celtic. You know, he kind of turned them into Celtic again. Yes, you know, Wim Jansen came along and broke the spell of Rangers, and that was a wonderful, wonderful achievement and a fantastic thing that you know, people, a lot of people probably don't realise that Wim Jansen had been part of the Feyenoord side that had beaten Celtic in the 1970 European Cup final. So, you know, there was a great deal of history between Jansen and Celtic before he even got the job. But for him to do this, but then O'Neill to come along and lay this new set of foundations for what has followed. You know, it's down to O'Neill that Celtic have become this dominant force and basically, you know, taken the mantle from Rangers once again.
Time's always against us in these things, and you know, we're already sort of an hour and 20, and you know, and looking to close it up, and you know, obviously, you know, there's far more to read about, you know, that we haven't even, you know, subjects that we haven't even touched on, you know, during this podcast, which, like I say, just goes to validate the reason why we've, you know, why we've done this magazine on Celtic Football Club. But I suppose a question for all three of you, and I'll come to all three of you with the same sort of question to finish with, and it's regard Celtic's place, in world football, European football, you know, domestic football. Where does it sit? You know, where does it sit currently? Where does it sit based on its heritage as being a European Cup winner? And I'm just sort of interested in how you guys see Celtic Football Club as a past and present entity, if you like. Chris, we'll come. You know, you're our guest. I'll come to you first, because as people speak, it gets more and more difficult. So I'll let you have first go at this one. You know, where do you see Celtic Football Club within football?
I think it's an interesting question, and as you were asking it, sort of the whole debate about Scottish clubs joining the English football infrastructure popped into my head, and increasingly it sort of crystallised in my own head that it's a pointless debate, because Celtic doesn't need English football, it doesn't need the Premier League for validation, because it stands on the weight of its history, and let's make no bones about it, Celtic's place at the top of the game is secured, not just because of the historical achievements, but because of the huge scope of the fan base, the sheer size of the club. You know, it is undisputably one of the biggest clubs in Britain, and it will continue to be so. And I think what people will find in this magazine is just reinforcement for that, the sheer number of stories, the sheer number of fantastic players and coaches, not to mention the absolutely amazing artwork we've commissioned for this magazine. You know, all you'll need to do is read this magazine, and you'll know, if you didn't know already, just how big a club this is, because it is huge.
Excellent. You're right. To be fair, you're absolutely right as well. Some of the artists that have been commissioned, you know, they've produced some wonderful, wonderful images, you know, to complement the words and the writing and the photographs that are also in there as well. Stephen, I'll come to you, because Gary, you started, so I'll finish with you, Gary, this time. So, Stephen, for you, you know, Chris has had his say as to, you know, regards where Celtic sits. I suppose final thoughts from you on Celtic Football Club.
The one of the legendary names of football, and the equally cursed and blessed in so many ways, and people will, you know, detract from them because of the perceived weakness of the league that they play in. But what makes Celtic is the club that they are, and the achievements that they have chiselled for themselves, and you can point to, you know, in a similar fashion, a Benfica for me. You know, they're as comparable as a Benfica, who are also, you know, damned to an extent that they're perceived to be in a, you know, a two or a three horse race for a league title. But, you know, they've risen above all that to kind of like become an iconic name. And Celtic are exactly the same. You know, yes, you know, only Celtic and Rangers have won the title for the best part of 35 years. But Celtic have come through multiple eras and always ended up bobbing back to the top in a similar way to how Benfica do in Portugal. You know, they are, you know, an absolute icon of a football club.
Gary, it gets more and more difficult, doesn't it, as we go down the line here. And, you know, final thoughts, Celtic Football Club, where they sit, how they're perceived?
Yeah, well, I think basically all opinions are defined by your perception, and you know, it depends where you're sitting there and where you're looking from. And I absolutely agree 100% with what Chris says. You know, if you're looking at how Celtic is defined by their fans, then it's one of the biggest clubs in Britain, no doubt. If you're a fan of a mid-ranking Premiership team, you might look at it differently. And that's what football's all about. It's all about opinions. But what can't be disputed is that the history of Celtic will always guarantee them a place at top European football, because they did something that no British club had ever done before and set in train perhaps a great respect for the tournament that became, you know, the holy grail for so many English clubs. So Celtic remain a massive name in British football. Celtic remain a massive name in European football. And almost regardless of whether you're a fan of an English club who thinks Scottish football might be a little bit weak, or you're a fan of Celtic, or even of Rangers, I don't think it's possible at all to disavow that opinion.
Guys, it's a great way to finish. It's been brilliant, wonderful listening to you. Like you said, between us, you know, we've only contributed 4 articles. There's so much more in the magazine. And like Chris said, you know, it will give you, you know, you don't have to be a Celtic fan to enjoy reading about the clubs that we write about. You know, I talk a lot about being a fan of football. And again, you know, if you are a fan of football, hopefully these are the stories that people are going to want to read about, that people are interested in, and will give a newfound appreciation, if there wasn't already one, about Celtic Football Club. Ready to order. Make the purchase, I suppose, is probably all I can say there. Chris, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Pleasure, as always.
Hopefully, like I said, the fact that Liverpool lost to Watford will see you through the rest of this season.
I'll be basking in that glow for weeks.
Gary, good luck with the cup draw. But again, thank you for certainly such a passionate opening with regards to Dewey Johnson, Jock Steen, and that, you know, and sort of setting the tone really for this whole podcast.
Yeah, cheers, Chris. It's been a great fun again talking about football with some knowledgeable guys. And you know, I perhaps should have mentioned, you know, what defines Celtic as a big club is because these Football Times have produced a magazine about them.
That's it. One of the 7 biggest clubs in the world now. That's it.
You've got it, matey.
Stephen, as always, you know, an absolute pleasure just to yarn about the beautiful game and use any excuse to do it, really.
Oh, joy as always. I think we'd just kind of like do conference chats anyway, even if we weren't recording now. But once a week, you know. But no, a joy as always, Steve. A joy as always.
Excellent.
Your poor Wes must never see you just sitting and talk to each other all night, do you?
Yeah, pretty much. If I don't have headphones on, yeah, it doesn't feel right if I'm not talking through headphones. It's just not right. My kids don't like it, but other than that, it's all right. Guys, you know, like I say, time to go. Thank you so much. All that's left for me to say, a couple of things. Please, like I say, you know, if you are interested in Celtic Football Club, I'm not going to say if you're a Rangers fan, because that's just asking too much. But if you are interested in Celtic, in Scottish football, and football in general, you know, it's a great investment. And obviously the smell that we always like to mention of those new magazines when they arrive. And also, thank you for listening to us on the Lob podcast with these Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.